Tonight I'm going to run through a number of distinctions and kind of give an overview, a sort of image of different views that people have had about souls throughout history and a little bit of their relationship to ways of thinking about that in relationship to contemporary neuroscience. I'm going to start, though, with the topic of the human person, because often what gets foregrounded too quickly is we jump into brains and souls and don't quite think about why we even wanted them in the first place. And what I'm going to try to draw attention to is ways in which people have thought souls or brains provide different or complementary or competitive explanatory accounts of human persons. So start with the thing, the explanandum, the thing we want to explain first. Then I'm going to look at three different types of explanatory concepts of souls, as well as looking at some others as well. And then I'm going to briefly give what I've referred to sometimes as a 2,500-year potted history of the developments of our understanding of the brain and how its relationship to different concepts of soul. And the reason for that is, if there's anything like a thesis, is that these concepts of soul have been defended on purely philosophical grounds, and the different concepts have had different understandings of the way in which biology is related to the soul. And those philosophical concepts of soul have surprisingly been resilient to major changes in biology. It's not that they've ignored those major changes in biology, rather those changes in biology aren't maybe perhaps as radically undermining of those philosophical concepts of soul as we might think, and that two very different views of souls, Aristotelian souls and Cartesian souls, have been able consistently to accommodate themselves to that. But not only that, for a long time they drove the developments of these biological disciplines in themselves. So anyway, the point will be at the end is that it's not so obvious that neuroscience is what's going to render these concepts of soul problematic. Rather, it's going to be that they're just bad philosophical arguments or not convincing philosophical arguments for these concepts of soul. So the opening question just is the soul obsolete? Has it worn out its usefulness? Has it been replaced by neuroscience? And one thing we need to develop is more articulateness in this history of these concepts of soul and these different ideas. Can everyone hear me okay? Yeah? Okay. Because I might step away from the microphone a little bit. But what I want to look at first is a little bit of the differences between an experiential concepts of soul and distinguish that from these explanatory concepts of soul. Before even doing that, I want to look briefly at what do we even mean by concepts. There's lots of different controversial views about what even concepts are. But we need to get clear about this first and see how their role they play. So concepts are conceived by insights, attempts to understand something, and they're generated by our inquiries and our attempts to clothe phenomena, or data, or our experiences, to try to make them intelligible to us. So we develop different kinds of concepts. And we use concepts to try to describe, explain, or make sense of our experiences in life, even in our efforts to try to make sense of living and dying, and then the host of other things that orbit that central existential questions about living and dying. More specifically, concepts, as I'm using, they're acquired rational capacities that govern and are generative of the ways we understand and articulate what we understand about things, conscious experiences of things, and so forth. So they're ways in which they come through linguistic means, but they transcend languages. I mean, they're translatable into different languages with certain semantic losses and certain semantic gains. But when you come to acquire concepts, you gain facility, you gain an ability. You are now enabled to talk competently about chemistry in a way you couldn't before. You're now able to talk competently about American baseball in a way that you weren't before. So when you gain concepts, they provide a way of shedding light on phenomena that you otherwise wouldn't be able to understand so well. But it's important to draw attention here that not all conceptual understanding is theoretical understanding. Theories develop systematic reflection and use and application of concepts. So they expand from our basic use of concepts, which is pre-theoretical. One thing that's a helpful analogy here is thinking about concepts kind of like a garment, like an item of clothing. And garments enable wearers to engage in different activities, to perform certain functions, They might be protective, so there's different types of formal wear or athletic wear, and some of them enable and allow you to do certain things better, and others are inhibiting in other ways. Some are protective for like deep sea diving. So garments perform lots of different functions, and concepts are work in a similar way. They enable you in certain areas to work really efficiently and well, but they maybe aren't appropriate for other contexts, and we have to acquire other concepts that help us discriminate between where they can be applied and where they can't be applied well. And one thing about concepts is, like clothing, you have to get comfortable with them. So when you first hear some new concepts or new ideas, it takes quite a bit of what some philosophers refer to as conceptual therapy. It's not immediately obvious on the face of it why this is a good idea or why this is a helpful idea. And so it takes quite a few sessions, as it were, to get comfortable with some of these concepts. And that's going to be true of a lot of concepts about soul, or even the first time you start studying neuroscience. These are foreign concepts, and they don't really quite make sense. So putting them in their historical context, I hope, will provide some clarity to that. But another thing about our concepts is not only do they enable us, sometimes certain concepts are distorting. They're more like a straitjacket rather than something that enables us. So lots of things that would be obvious are just types of implicit biases that people talk about, and ways in which concepts can affect types of racism, or they can affect the way in which we look at the political spectrum, and we only think of ourselves as being right or left, and we bundle all the issues that we're interested in under these concepts. Or even the way in which we think about souls can be debilitating, or the way in which we might think about what justice is, or what sin is, or what grace is. There's lots of different ways in which ideas that we can be committed to can be inhibiting just as much as they can be enabling. So I bring up all this because we're asking this question, what does it mean for the soul to be obsolete? Is this now a concept that's just worn out, and it's now only one that's restrictive, it's like a straitjacket? Or is there any way in which it actually provides explanation and illuminates things, and that we can't do without it? Important point to draw attention to with our concepts is, where did they come from? When we get educated and we become initiated into practices of education, the institutions often have a curriculum. They have a set of courses that you have to take. They have professors who teach a curriculum in a certain way, and they initiate you into concept acquisition, amongst other things. And as you learn them, you become competent, and perhaps become competent enough to become a teacher yourself of these concepts. You become competent in economics, you become competent in statistics. But these concepts have an authority that you take for granted as you're learning them, and as you learn them, they provide the resources for you to justify that authority, why you took for granted that this is what microbiology is all about. Concepts of soul work in the same way. So we inherit them in our social imaginaries, as Charles Taylor would say. They're just kind of part of the milieu of the atmosphere of things, but we don't necessarily stop and reflect on them and work through an articulation of them in detail. And one thing that comes up in linguistic anthropology, this distinction I'm about to talk about, that also has now been applied broadly in cultural anthropology, is this distinction between etics and emics, or sometimes it's between actors' categories and analysts' categories. And the idea is that what anthropologists discovered is that, you know, they would spend years in the classroom learning all about witchcraft and theories about witchcraft, and then they would go out and they would study some community that had certain practices and beliefs about witchcraft, but their theory kind of bulldozed over what was actually going on in this particular community, and similar issues arise in other contexts. But the distinction is that ethics here is the application of our theories and analyzing others' behaviors and institutions from emics. And emics is the interpretation of others' worlds as they appear to them. So emics is like going native, understanding the way natives understand things, and ethics is using just a theory. And there's something of a tension here between, do we go in with our theories, or do we just try to only understand those in terms of their emics, their local native ways of understanding it? And if you only do emics, it's very difficult to translate that in any other context and make any generalizations. But if you only have the ethics, if you only have the theory, you might conceal from yourself. You have a conceptual straitjacket that might cause impediments for you to be able to understand the local communities that you're studying. But this applies in our own settings as well. Where do we come up with the theoretical concepts that we use? And I'm not sure how many of you in research labs or things like this, but you get very specialized very quickly, and people down the hall might actually be working on something very similar, but they go to different conferences, they publish in different journals, they their research is becoming siloed in a way that makes it incommunicable to others. And what develops is these etics, these theoretical constructs that sometimes are a bit oblivious or can conceal from oneself these emics, these native ways of doing that. So we have to be also cautious about very psychological concepts like free will, about conscience, about consciousness, about a range of topics. And to what degree are we using etics that we've derived from emics, or we've just, every emic, every community we've looked at, we've applied our concepts of consciousness, our concepts of memory, our concepts of vision and things to these contexts. One lesson Nick Jardine draws is that we actually need both of these, and we need them deeply synthesized, that we need to keep this tension. He makes this line that etics, the theoretical, without the emics, are empty. But also the emics without the etics are blind. So we need to have both of them brought together. This is why it's also important to look at the history of these concepts, because we'll come to appreciate that free will hasn't meant the same thing even in lots of different Christian developments and other developments of the concept. So we might think free will is intuitive, but it's important to draw attention to the fact that Aristotle and Plato don't have explicit concepts of free will. They talk about voluntary action and responsibility, but they don't necessarily have explicit doctrine of free will until you get to someone like St. Augustine or the Stoics about 500 years after them. But even later doctrines of free will that we have, those are very different from Augustine's view about free will. So which concepts are being operationalized in our scientific experiments? This is a very important question. I'm not sure how many of you work in social sciences or work in psychology. How many people are familiar with weirdness in psychology? Yeah, so weirdness is, if you are weird, it's because you are from a Western, educated, industrialized, rich, democratic place. You've grown up in one of those, and it means that you are a very unusual person in the history of Homo sapiens. But all, or nearly all, experimental research in psychology and the social sciences is done on subjects that are weird. It's pretty hard to move around an fMRI machine all over the place and just pop people into it, and amongst other things. All these experiments on free will, experiments on consciousness, they're done on subjects that are weird. That's not a problem if the way in which we generalize from this is these subjects are weird, and weird subjects are conscious in this kind of way, or weird subjects have these features of memory. But it's not only that it's these weird people, it's even a minority amongst those weird people. And some of you might have been the beneficiaries of this, the fact that most of these experiments are done on people who are ages 18 to 23, because they're volunteers at universities who will gladly go put an EEG cap on their head for an Amazon gift card or a discount of this sort of thing. But this is the least representative population of Homo sapiens ever. And most of our psychological and sociological research is drawn from etics and emics that are just focused on that group, and we're making these generalizations that are beyond that. So it's just trying to draw some critical reflection to the kind of concepts we use when we think about soul, when we think about brains, when we think about neuroscience and what neuroscience is telling us, and what concepts they're using that they operationalize in their experiments. How broad are these concepts? Are they actually universalizable to all human persons, all human peoples, or are they actually more limited than they sometimes present? So now I'm going to turn our attention to some of these varieties of what I mean by experiential concepts of soul. Mostly just to say how important and valuable these are, but to set them aside is very different from what I think the real contentious points are about. There's varieties of just experiential images or logoi of the soul, where we just sort of say, you know, like soul music, or speak about the heart, or speak about the mind or the spirit, or the self or the conscience. These are just existential ways of using soul that are important, and are important for communicating rhetorically what we mean by things, but they aren't necessarily committing ourselves to something deeper metaphysically. Okay, so I'm not downplaying them. They have extraordinary great rhetorical significance, and people who don't believe in souls in this metaphysical sense are as likely to use these concepts, and they're not necessarily committed to anything deeper than that. But we should ponder why they are so indispensable to our lives, this wide variety of concepts that are all related to existential significance, about what it is to live and die, the kind of things we care about most. But what's probably most important about drawing attention to them is that they're likely to be the launching pad for our more theoretical explanatory concepts of soul. So we need to be careful about what do we mean by these experiential concepts, just the experience of deep passion, the experience of deep worries or anxieties about illnesses, about sickness, about trauma, about tragedies that occur, those kind of uses of soul. How do those connect us up to these more deeper explanatory ones? So as I was saying before, what I think is a more adequate starting point for this sort of reflection is not to just think about these rhetorically significant uses of soul or spirit or mind or heart, but to focus more on the experience of being a human person, as that is a sort of starting point concept, and then thinking about to what degree do the concepts of soul and the studies in neuroscience add anything to our everyday understanding of human persons. So first is, what is a human person? There's a lot of disagreement about this, but I think the starting point that we need to have is begin more with common sense. But it's important to draw attention to this, something that anthropologists will show us. There's no such thing as just common sense. Common sense is culturally varied. It's very complicated. There's also no such thing as the theoretical image or the scientific image of human beings. Scientists disagree about lots of different things about what human beings are. Philosophers have a range of disagreements about them. In other words, it's just messy. There's lots of different views that are out there. And the sort of idea that there's one decisive view out there also is a straitjacket. It can conceal from ourselves the complicated issues. But we should really be aware of this, given how much we disagree with each other. So part of our common sense understanding of human persons needs to be that what human beings are, they're the kind of beings that disagree about fundamental issues, the kind of beings that disagree about practical issues, and the kind of beings who disagree in a variety of different theoretical ways. That's what should be a matter of common sense. But it's important to try to start there and think about what do ordinary people do when they try to make sense of themselves? What do you do when you try to make sense of yourself in a very casual way, in which many of you might have done? I don't know how many people already know each other, but when you're over at the coffee and you're just talking to someone and introducing yourself, or at a conference, or at, you know, just meeting people, to what degree do you lay out some theoretical explanation? I'm a Homo sapiens, I'm from this lineage, my clan and tribe did this. Or to what degree do you just tell a story about your family and where you come from? The role of narrative is central to this common sense image of persons. And those always need to be kept in view, because we need a story for how those connect to our theoretical inquiries in philosophy or theology or in the sciences. How does one's life make sense with respect to these theoretical inquiries and these theoretical commitments about ourselves? So there needs to be an interesting and important dialectical balance of going back between one's own narrative as becoming perhaps a scientist, perhaps becoming an educator, becoming a theologian, becoming someone who's becoming competent to be an entrepreneur. How do all these things fit within my life, and how do these theoretical concepts have implications for that as well? So here, somewhat contentiously, but the kind of view of human persons I'm taking for granted is that we're developing dependent rational animals. This is a kind of idea that comes from a Catholic philosopher, Alistair MacIntyre, has a book on dependent rational animals. A human person is a someone, not a mere something. Human persons are endowed with powers of practical reason and free will, and this enables us to be self-determining, responsible agents. Allows us to act voluntarily and intentionally in accordance with, or maybe against or contrary to, various normative intelligible order of goods. There's a lot in there. And this is all very contentious. Most people don't agree with this. Some people do. But you'll find something very much like this in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, but also you'll find a range of philosophical arguments as well in defense of these kind of ideas. The special forms of human agency are comprised of capacities for self-knowledge as well as self-determination. But it's really important that our ability for free will, our ability to be a voluntary agent, it's one that we gradually develop these kinds of agency. We don't start off with that. We slowly develop from just basic motile flailings to slowly controlled activity that we can move towards objects and eventually begin to identify objects more adequately. And so we should think of agency and free will as it develops out of infancy and into adolescence, and that free will is not this homogeneous one-size-fits-all thing. It's a really complicated thing that has to do a lot with one's development. But that development would be impossible apart from our dependency on others, of family members, of caregivers, of siblings and parents, of institutions and educational opportunities that actually enable you to have options to choose from in your developing agency and free will. So these are all pretty commonsensical things that we need to keep in view before we start articulating too detailed of a theory about human persons, and try to think about in what way might the nervous system, what way might the brain provide an explanation for these developmental patterns of agency, and what way might souls provide explanations for this. An important distinction Aristotelians like to make here is that the development of humans endows them with a suite of powers, capacities, or abilities. We acquire these abilities or dispositions, and it's one thing to acquire them, and it's another thing to exercise them. So it's one thing to acquire a certain kind of knowledge, maybe competency in chemistry, and it's another thing to actually exercise that competency in chemistry. This becomes important for how Aristotelians respond to different views about personal identity. So I'm just rushing through all this philosophy right now. But here's two rival different views that you might have already identified yourself having thought of what is personal identity or what is it for me to be me and to continue on. A really popular one, perhaps even the dominant one in philosophy, is a Neo-Lockean, a view based somewhat on the views of John Locke, that's based on a type of psychological identity. What is it to be a person? It's to have some sort of psychological continuity. In other words, there's a continuity of maybe your memories, or maybe a continuity of consciousness, or some other psychological capacities or states. So, if you were to become incapacitated and incapable of being conscious or incapable of having the relevant psychological states, you would cease to be a person. If you were to develop a really terrible form of Alzheimer's, dementia, and you were to become uncognizant of yourself and others, on this account, for some versions of this account, you would just cease to be a person at that point in time. Also, you weren't a person when you were conceived. You weren't probably a person. You may have been a person depending on what conscious states matter, or sentient states matter for personhood on this account. You might not even been a person when you were born. It might not have even been a person until you had rational competencies. So this is a model of personhood that is very much deeply tied to different views about psychological continuity of some kind. There's a variety of versions of this account that are going to focus on memory or consciousness or them. Some are more sophisticated than others. Some of them are about the most sophisticated of philosophical views that are out there. As I said, this is the dominant view. Okay. There's also a very important rival view, which is the one that I endorse, which is connected to this view about us being developing dependent rational animals. And it's very different. It focuses more on organic continuity of the human being. It's an organic continuity from the beginning to the end of life of a developing dependent rational animal. It's one that recognizes in the dementia case that human beings throughout their lives develop different psychological competencies. That's part of just what we are, is the kind of biological beings we are, not to mention the kind of metaphysical beings that we are. So these can change considerably. You can have people who have horrible kinds of dementia. They don't lose their personhood. On this account, what's the range in psychology, the range in psychological competencies, we instead refer to as their personality. So there's a distinction here at the bottom between our psychological identity, your personality, one that is never fixed, one that's radically changing depending on your relationships, your friends, your endocrine system, a whole host of factors that constitute your personality. And these can go through enormous radical changes without changing what you are fundamentally, the kind of animal that you are, the kind of personhood that you are. So a rational animal's personhood grounds the biological and the different psychological abilities or powers that enable our conscious social life and the development of the rational animal's personality. This is a really key distinction. This is the heart of a serious philosophical debate that's been ongoing for about 20 or 30 years, and I mean, as all philosophical debates, it's not decisive. It's really complicated why people are committed to the views that they are. It has a lot to do with your worldview. It also has a lot to do with the strength of these arguments. It's not an either or, it's a balance of these two things and other commitments they have. Related to this is another helpful distinction, and this one is particularly helpful for trying to think through what do we want to make of the way in which biology, neuroscience, endocrine systems, glial systems. How are these related to our psychology? Whether you're an animalist, holding the second view there, or the more psychological approach, both of them can look to this distinction for thinking through what they might want to say about the relation of them. Sometimes this is in terms of the personal or subpersonal distinction, but here I'm going to articulate it in terms of just the psychological and subpsychological. We've already used person so much, we're not going to fog things up by using it in a third or fourth different way. By psychological attributes, I mean things like our conscious awareness, perceptions, emotions, memory, imagination, our ability to inquire, ask questions, having insights, practical reasoning, theoretical forms of reasoning, intentional actions, belief, desires. I mean, the list goes on of a range of psychological attributes. By subpsychological attributes, I mean things like the nervous system or cardiovascular system, a digestive system. Things, though, that are in particular somehow connected up and probably necessary requirements in order to exercise these psychological capacities. So they're going to have a very important connection to each other, a connection that is contentiously debated by neuroscientists and philosophers, amongst others. Now, the important thing about this distinction is it's not a panacea. It doesn't really solve philosophical problems. It doesn't explain anything. It's one of these concepts that's trying to put everything in the right baskets rather than some of the more distorting straitjackets. And it doesn't yet explain what the relationship is between the two. So there's a host of different philosophical views that can be had just by using this distinction. But it is a helpful one insofar as if we want to start talking about the brain, and we want to maybe talk about the visual system, and you want to ask, is the brain belong in the psychological category? Not as I've defined it, but others would want to say the brain just is as much in that psychological category as anything else. So maybe the subpsychological is actually, you know, quantum field theory or something like that. So there's not necessarily agreement even on how this distinction is to be deployed and how it's to be used. Given this distinction the way I've defined it, which is contentious, is that human persons are developing dependent rational animals, and the way we should think about their brains is that humans have brains, but they're not identical to their brains. Their personality, their psychology, their personhood, that's not identical to their brains. But the brain is definitely a necessary critical factor for enabling the possibility of all these psychological attributes. So it's humans and other animals, not their brains, that see, hear, perceive, and this long list of psychological descriptions I have there. But having a brain is a necessary condition for enabling many of the embodied powers of cognition, of emotion, of motivation, and volition that we have as humans. Okay, so moving on now to explanatory concepts of soul. So I've tried to give just a rough picture, a contentious one, as any picture is, of how complicated human persons are. What souls and brains are supposed to do is provide some explanation for various features or phenomena that have to do with human persons. In other words, they're going to be in the background. They're not going to be part of the more experiential story here. They're going to be something that's not so obvious. Things that we're a little bit clueless on why are humans this way, or what explains why this can happen in this way. So they're not foreground issues, they're background issues of human persons. We start with human persons, and we move on to trying to understand them biologically by looking at their nervous system or cardiovascular system, or trying to understand what keeps them being the unity that they are. That's what the role of certain concepts of soul are supposed to play. So I'm going to look briefly at three different kinds of concepts of soul. The first is a biological concept of soul, then a psychological concept of soul, and then finally spiritual eschatological concepts of soul. The biological concept of soul is really old. This goes back to Aristotle in 4th century BC and what I'm going to call Aristotelian animating forms. So Aristotle has this fancy view that people have come to call hylomorphism because he thinks all physical things are composed from matter and their form. The thing that's organized and the thing that does the organizing. But they're not things, it's the thing is composed of both of them. So Aristotelians believe in a kind of form or organizational realism. They think the thing organized, the matter, is just as real and is no more real than the thing that does the organizing, the form. But neither of them are really things. They're explanatory principles for talking about things that are composed from form and matter. Here's a brief summary by a contemporary hylomorphist of this view. So the idea here is that formal organization isn't just something we kind of impose upon the world the way we perceive it. It's something real. It operates as an irreducible ontological principle. It accounts at least in part for what things essentially are. form makes matter and the whole to be what it is. It also makes a difference causally. It operates as an irreducible explanatory principle. It one that accounts at least in part for what things can do and the powers they have. And formal organization counts. It explains the unity of composite things. So why are these composite things that are changing in all these radical ways, why do they also somehow persist and stay the same kind of thing that they are? Including the persistence of one and the same living individual through the dynamic influx and efflux of matter and energy that characterize many of its interactions with the world. So this Aristotelian concept of soul, it shouldn't be thought in a spiritual way or in a psychological way. It's just a basic understanding of not something spooky, but something that's just explaining why are organized things organized in the way that they are. It's giving an explanation for why it has the biological systems and the parts it has, not competing with those systems. It's providing a different level of explanation there. This is very different from different kinds of psychological concepts of soul, where I should say it's different from one version of a psychological concept of soul, namely an account of Cartesian minds. So the Aristotelian account of psychological souls is pretty much like the biological one. It just also is more than just living systems and covering things like metabolism and reproduction. It also now has to do with these basic psychological powers. So we need to contrast two different kinds of psychological concepts of soul. The first is Cartesian minds. Now, there's a lot of different varieties of this. There'd be non-Cartesian versions of this as well that would be different than what I'm saying. But this one starts off with the idea that a basic distinction in reality we should start with is that between the mental and the physical. And we should say that there's two kinds of substance in the world, or maybe at least two kinds of properties. There's mental properties or substances, and physical substances and properties. And typically on this count, one says that what I am, what the soul is my mind. And my soul or my mind can somehow be united to my body that's other than me. The Aristotelian animating forms view just continues with that same story before. What souls are is not something separate from the body, it's the very thing that organizes the body and makes it organized in the way that it is. So it's one substance constituted from the unity of organic matter animated by form. There's a lot more details that have to go in, but we're almost done with all this technical stuff. Third concept is one that has to do more with mythology and revelation. It's more of a concept that has to do with religions. And this concept of soul can be very complicated in different ways, but it's nearly always has to be articulated using philosophical concepts. So this religious eschatological concept of soul often draws upon this Cartesian one, or older views like Platonic views of souls, or these Aristotelian souls. And so you find a variety of religious ways of talking about souls that often have a lot to do with these philosophical concepts. Either they overtly and explicitly draw upon them, or they don't necessarily recognize that that's what they've done. So that's just a very brief sketch of these three different kinds of explanatory concepts of soul and what role they're supposed to play. The first kind, the biological concept of soul, is meant to provide some explanation for why do living organisms stay the same kind of thing they are throughout their life, but yet they're always, through an efflux and influx of matter, changing in lots of radical ways, but yet they stay the same kind of being throughout there. So that biological concept of soul is meant to provide a metaphysical explanation, not in competition with biology, but at a different level from the biology, explaining why there's a unity here that we didn't make up, that we encounter in reality, and it needs some explanation. The psychological concepts of soul are meant to provide some explanation for why we have the psychological powers we do. Some of it by saying that there's some separate thing that's not physical at all, and another one saying that the soul is something very deeply embodied, like the biological one, but it also endows the animals with various psychological powers. The concept of soul using these religious spiritual concepts are often meant to articulate some way in which we're like God, or maybe the way in which the human being or the body can survive death and come to meet God, or provide a role for the resurrection of the body, say in Christianity, or in the doctrine of like the image of God. So there's lots of different explanatory roles that these concepts of soul can have. And in the Aristotelian case, Aristotelians like Thomas Aquinas or Duns Scotus or others, they combined all three of these together to have one doctrine that united all of them together. So uniting the biological with the psychological, and also having a religious element combined to it as well. So I'm going to give you a race course through 2,500 years of neuroscience, if that's okay. So, it's important to draw attention to the fact that whatever is encased behind the bone of our skull, that it's not a surprise to human beings to be told that this has something to do with our psychological abilities. The Hippocratic writings from the 4th and 5th century BC are very explicit about this. And this is from the Hippocratic writings work on the sacred disease, which was a reflection on epilepsy, which is kind of saying this is not necessarily a religious thing. Maybe it is a religious thing, but there's also physiological causes. So the Hippocratic writings in this short work on the sacred disease are kind of agnostic or not really interested in answering yes or no with respect to the religious. Are these people possessed? Are these people inspired? But it's trying to also draw attention to the fact that there's a physiological account here. And as you'll see here, they say the brain is the source of our joys, delights, laughter and sports, sorrows, griefs, despondency and lamentations. And by this, in a special manner, we acquire wisdom and knowledge and see and hear and know what are foul and what are fair, what are bad, what are good, what are sweet and what are unsavory. Quite a spectrum of psychological attributes that they're recognizing has some indispensable role related to the nervous system, to whatever it is, that fleshy stuff that's inside the skull. It's really important, that last point, because they don't really know what this fleshy stuff is inside the skull, and it's unclear exactly what explanatory role it's playing, but clearly they're also saying it has an indispensable role for understanding what's going on in epileptic seizures. But then surprisingly, my good buddy Aristotle thought there's some problems with the Hippocratic view about the role of the brain, or whatever that fleshy stuff is inside the skull, in trying to explain sensory and motor integration. And Aristotle came to the conclusion through his own dissections and his own experiments that the heart is not the brain, is the material organ that's central to our psychosomatic integration of our sensory and our motile powers. The heart is not the locus of the soul, however, because the Aristotelian view is that the soul is what's making all of the body to be the body that it is and is endowing with its power. So it's not as if the soul is touching the heart and that's what makes everything else alive. That's not the Aristotelian view at all that I was telling you earlier. It's one where it's the soul is still making everything biological to be organized and be the way that it is. So why did Aristotle make this account? His hylomorphic account of matter and form, of the way psychosomatic powers grounded in the soul-body composite, they formally organized these material powers of the heart, the blood vessels, and what he called the vital pneuma, the vital spirit, which is something material, but it's flowing through the vessels. So why did Aristotle move away from the brain and move towards the heart as the organ that integrates them? It's really he just lacked the facts. Aristotle didn't have adequate anatomical knowledge of the distinction between blood vessels and nerves. So he sees all these things coming in and out, but they're all, as far as he can tell, they're all coming in and out of the heart. So the organ that's integrating all of the vessels, based on his, and Aristotle's anatomical knowledge is extraordinarily sophisticated. I mean, he more or less, he didn't quite invent the discipline, but he really pushed the sciences in that direction. So for him, he understood that the brain instead, and he's thinking in particular about the ventricles, the large cavities that we know are filled with cerebral spinal fluid. He thought the task of the brain is to cool the blood and keep it at an appropriate temperature. And so Aristotle is not making this distinction, and given the lack of his anatomical knowledge, it's quite reasonable to think all the motor and sensory information is going into the heart, because he hasn't yet made this distinction. It's not until about 400 years later, now in 200, just in the 2nd century AD, that Galen, who's also a kind of Aristotelian, utilized the anatomy of this distinction between the blood vessels and the nerves and set things right. Now, what's significant is Galen and other Aristotelians aren't going to change Aristotle's doctrine of soul and body to accommodate this massive shift. And if there's anything that's a massive shift in the history of Aristotelian reflections on the soul and the body, it's this one. Nothing else that comes after this will be any more significant than thinking the central organ for responsible for our psychological abilities is the heart, and then shifting to thinking now it's something in the brain. That's the largest medical breakthrough, so to speak, or scientific discovery that will occur in the history of Aristotelian thought. And this is not something that's going to make them change and have to rethink their doctrine in any substantive way. what Galen focuses our attention on are the ventricles. Okay, and that is going to be the focus now for basically the next 1500 years of medical science, is going to focus on the ventricles, these large cavities that hold cerebral spinal fluid, which they have important maintenance role to play, but they are not the most important factor for enabling our ability to have the kind of psychological attributes that we have. What developed here is the idea that the nerves are connected to muscles, to the spinal cord, which is connected with the ventricles of the brain. And this required Galen to have to distinguish between vital pneuma, the thing that's flowing through the bloods, from psychic pneuma, what he thinks is the fluid flowing through the ventricles and flowing through the nerves. Not too much longer, Nemesius, who is a Christian bishop, he developed on this by thinking that what we should do is actually localize our different psychological abilities in the different ventricles. So we thought so they basically at this time in the anatomy, they just think that there's three big cavities like this, which is a 14th century, I think it's 14th century. No, the next one is. Sorry, this is a 15th century image of, oh, I actually have a laser pointer for the first time. This is the anterior ventricle, medial, and then the posterior. This is not what they look like at all, as we'll see in just a moment. But this is a little bit later, where Thomas Aquinas, who adopted this doctrine, which was developed considerably by the Muslim philosopher Avicenna, and was received in the Latin West in the 13th century. But this is an image from a commentary on from Albert the Great, who is also Dominican, from the 15th century, from 1490. But they localize the power of the common sense, which integrates all of our senses, in the frontal or anterior ventricle. And they also somehow thought they could subdivide the two of them and put the imagination there. This other power of estimation and cogitation they put there, and they put the power of memory back there. And so all throughout the Middle Ages, you see different theories of where they put these. Leonardo da Vinci also endorsed this doctrine. But da Vinci is really important for us because we have these different illustrations of his. So we have his earlier illustrations, where he just more or less copies the ventricle doctrine without having really any better anatomical knowledge. And then what da Vinci did is he injected wax into ox brains, into the ventricles, and then took everything apart and discovered that they're not three huge cavities. They're rather, well, the ones are lateralized and they're shaped kind of like horns. And we also have these later illustrations of his as well, which show that they're completely different, but yet he still gives the threefold division for how the ventricles are divided in those powers. So up until this point in time, and this is what they actually look like, and of course this is not where, this is more of a maintenance system for the nervous system and for the brain. It's not where what's the critical tissue that, if it gets damaged, you're going to have some problems for sure. But it's not the sort of thing that's causing serious issues. It's not where the neurodegeneration is happening, say, in Alzheimer's. We finally start getting more accurate anatomical illustrations of it a century later. And then finally we get Descartes, who is going to switch to a more mechanistic account of these. But he's going to localize the mind's connection to the body in a very different way, going away from the Aristotelian account to soul to that one that I described earlier. And he's going to locate the connection in the pineal gland. But Descartes thought that the pineal gland was in the ventricles. So he was still thinking kind of like a ventriculist, but it actually turns out it's part of the tissue of the nervous system. And that was a really critical mistake because it drew attention to thinking about that instead. And not much longer, Thomas Willis at Oxford is going to shift from Descartes' pineal gland to the corpus callosum, and you can't really see it, but these images are from Thomas Willis's dissections that were done by Christopher Wren early on in his life before he went off and designed some of the beautiful buildings that we have in the UK. Skipping way, way ahead now to the major generation of serious pioneers in neuroscience of the 20th century of Sherrington and Penfield and then John Eccles. They persisted in having this largely Cartesian view about the mind and it having some particular location or locations in the nervous system in which it connected. So the best neuroscientists, neurophysiologists of the 20th century were still using a modified view of this philosophical concept of soul, now thought of as mind, now thought of as consciousness. and trying to find locations where they thought there was a coordination between the brain and the conscious mind. And John Eccles, for instance, has this very complicated view, which I won't go into. But it's still nevertheless a dualist view. What has persisted now that people, basically since the mid-20th century, have shifted away from being types of property dualists or substance dualists, they now more or less think of the brain is actually just doing all the information processing, and that just is what consciousness is or the cognitive activities. But they're still having a type of dualism of thinking of the brain as one thing and then the human as another thing. So there's still this type of conceptual straight, if you think it's a straitjacket, as I do, they're still operating the same kind of Cartesian dualism, but now it's a totally materialist version of it and haven't freed themselves from that. So all this is meant to suggest is that these philosophical concepts of soul, these explanatory accounts, they're still with us in lots of complicated ways, but the neuroscience isn't what has radically changed their minds. They've found ways to have these different accounts of soul accommodate and still provide explanations in different ways despite these radical changes in the biological sciences. And going over time, I'll stop there, and thank you very much for your attention.